It's better to give than to receive. Do you believe that?
Yes.
Well, it's the right answer. I mean, sounds like a churchy thing, you know. All right, bonus points. Who said it? You shout it out. No, no, no. Who said it's better to give than to receive? Take a guess. Jesus is always a good guess in church. It's always a good guess in church. And you get half credit. Because Paul says it in the book of Acts, but he attributes it to Jesus. We just don't have it in any of the Gospels. Sounds like something that he would say, right? Anyway, Paul knows this. Paul knows this personally through his own experience, because Paul was all about giving from the time he had this direct face-to-face encounter with the risen Jesus. He serves and gives of himself in extraordinary ways. He goes from town to town. He establishes churches, and it's not like they were just welcoming him. He had to fight verbally. He had to defend himself physically. He was beaten. He was imprisoned, shipwrecked. And he writes this from prison near the end of his life. So he knows what it is to give. And he's writing to Timothy, and even now here at the end of his life, he's giving not only to Timothy, one of his proteges, but he's giving to everyone who is going to be influenced by Timothy through the churches where he serves, and anyone who's going to read these words eventually, up to and including us. And the setting is not only nearing the end of Paul's life, but he was convinced that because he had had this face-to-face encounter with Jesus so quickly, that there would be a coming of Jesus again, and that would happen soon. And so he says, live now as though that's already happened. Live into that so that when he does come, it's not going to be like some strange experience for you. You say, oh, yeah, I know you. And that's, you know, there are a couple different ways that we can approach that as followers of Jesus. We can say, well, you know, what we say and what we do and how we act, none of that matters now, because he's going to come again and fix everything in the sweet by and by. Or Paul's way, and what we try and encourage here, is to live into it. Live as though it's already happened. So it won't be a totally unexpected thing when it does. So included in that, Paul says to Timothy, as a teacher, you're going to have to be extraordinarily patient because your hearers are extraordinarily impatient. How many of you are educators in the room? Okay. So who takes more out of you? The kids who sit docilely and say, just pour it into me, or the ones who are a little bit squirmy and squirrely and impatient? Right? It's not a trick question. The Apostle Paul knows it, but the impatience that he's talking about here is in the form of one wanting to hear what they want to hear. He says they won't put up with good teaching. They're going to go looking for what pleases them, and that's going to demand extraordinary patience on your part. Jesus knows this too. He knows the patience that's required in teaching impatient people. His impatient people in this case are the disciples. They're not named in this version of the story, but this story of who's the greatest among us is described in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three of the synoptics. And in Matthew and Mark, this discussion is attributed to James and John, the two sons of Zebedee. In fact, in Mark, it's not even James and John. They get their mother to go and advocate on their behalf. Okay, guys, I'll give you a clue. If your mom has to tell people how great you are, Yeah, okay. So what's up with this? How is it that they... Oh, and here's another one. Sorry. In Luke's gospel, this takes place during the Last Supper, which really, I think, amplifies both the irony and the poignancy of what follows. Because in the Last Supper, Jesus has said, you know, this meal that we've celebrated for hundreds of years, commemorating our predecessors, our ancestors' deliverance from captivity in Egypt and the Passover. This bread that we've had every year, now this bread is my body. And it's given for you. And every time now when you have this meal, you're going to do this in my memory. And then he says, this wine, this cup that we've been enjoying all night long, says, this cup is now not just wine. This is my blood poured out for you for the forgiveness of sin. Every time you do this now, going forward, I'll be with you. You're remembering me, and I'm there with you. And then Jesus, from there, says, but one of you is going to betray me. One of you is going to betray me. So they engage in this discussion over who it won't be. Not I. Not I. I would never do such a thing. I love you, Lord. I'll love you till the end. Aren't I one of your favorites? When you go off with just a few of us, aren't I? So they're using proximity to Jesus to claim greatness for themselves. And so you can see the movement from not I to I'm the greatest. Jesus is really patient with them. You know, he could just put the hammer down. But he knows he doesn't have a lot of time with them, and so what he says really matters. He's not trying to score a winning point. He wants them to get it. And throughout his ministry, Jesus has contrasted the ways of the world with the ways of God. It's how he teaches. You've heard it said, but I say to you, the kingdom of God is like, and here he is again. You know, the Gentiles, their rulers lord it over them. Not so with you. You know, in the ways of the world, those who are served are superior to those who serve. But get your heads around this one, people. I am here. I, who you call Lord, am here among you as one who serves, bringing together the ways of the world. Right? The ways of the world and the ways of God converge in Jesus. And so he doesn't beat on them for this desire for greatness. Rather, he redirects it. He says, you know, fine, you want to be great? Outdo each other in serving. Be the greatest self-giving person you can be. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King preached a sermon on the Mark version of this text 2 months before he was assassinated. And it wasn't like on the White House or the Washington Mall. This was in his home church in Atlanta. And it was called the Drum Major Instinct. So it's an extraordinary sermon. Some of it's, you know, historically conditioned, but a lot of it's timeless. And it's what Dr. King calls this desire for greatness, the drum major instinct, the desire to be out in front leading the band, being important. And he says this is not just a significant human instinct. He says it's the most basic human instinct. I don't know if social scientists would agree with that today, but he was saying it was the most basic human instinct, significance, importance. And Dr. King says, you know, Jesus, what he's doing there is he's recognizing that it's an argument they don't have to have, because if where they're trying to be great is serving, everybody can be great. Everyone can be great. Not just the smartest, not the most talented, not the most charming, not the wealthiest, not the most powerful, not the most musically gifted, not even only the most spiritual. If the measure of greatness is in serving, then every one of us has greatness within us. Not greater than, but greatness within us. Jesus would know this from firsthand experience. Jesus' self-giving bridges and fills the gap between God and humanity forever and in every way. Jesus' self-giving puts definition and clarity and visibility about what it is to live God's way. You want to know? Here, watch me. Listen to me. Jesus' self-giving destroys all of our greatest fears and that which would destroy us. And Jesus' self-giving establishes a community of followers that do as he does, that empty themselves for others. What a turn it is that these, what we say, flawed followers have just enough of him within them that they begin this movement that we're still part of today. And because Jesus gives of himself, those who follow him give in such a way that things like education, we would not know education as we do were it not for the serving of the church, not just recently, but going back as far as you can go back. Healthcare is what it is because people who follow Jesus and wanted to serve as he served, take care of people when it didn't make sense to take care of them. What we call human rights are unimaginable apart from the influence of Jesus' self-giving and the serving of those who follow. And I think even human rights is, we could maybe sharpen that term and call it something like divine design. So Jesus serves, and therefore we serve. I mean, that's really it. You don't need any more than that. Jesus serves, and so we serve. But I'm going to give you three more reasons, just in case that's not enough. The first is because the world needs it. There are hungry people. Not just metaphorically hungry, but physically hungry. There are afflicted people. I'm using the words from Isaiah. Afflicted in every way. Those for whom life is extraordinarily difficult. Sometimes messes of their own making. Oftentimes messes not of their making at all. And because we live in a world with hungry and afflicted people, the words of the prophet Isaiah are still true today. That when we pour ourselves out for the hungry, light shines in the darkness. The gloomiest possible day is as though it is the noontime sun shining right into. So we serve because the world needs it. Second reason we serve is because we, as the church, as the followers of Jesus, are the most likely to do so. About 25 or so years ago, there was a social scientist named Robert Putnam writing, I think they were hoping it would become a popular book by the title, but it was a very scholarly piece of work. He was a social scientist from Harvard. Anybody remember the book Bowling Alone? Some of you do. not enough for it to become popular. Right? So he wrote that book and a follow-up book called American Grace. And his field is cultural connection. Social connection. And Bowling Alone, you know, he was tracking the decline of all these ways in which people would get together, you know, back to the beginning of the 20th century. And he says, where are the Elks clubs anymore? Where are the bowling leagues anymore? And I remember growing up, my dad went, bowling night was Thursday night. He was in a league. And he says, now people go bowling alone. And he probably wasn't, I don't know when Wii came into being, now they bowl alone on the Wii machine at home. And he continued his research. And this second book that he wrote, called American Grace, talked about the impact of faith communities on this social capital, on people being connected, and the ways in which faith communities influence what people do. So here's back to the point of today. When I said we're the ones most likely to serve a world that needs it, he observed that people who are members of faith communities are far, far, far more likely to volunteer in any capacity, sacred or secular, far more likely to serve on the school board, far more likely to bake cookies for the class, far more likely to coach Little League, far more likely to take a petition around the neighborhood, even far more likely to let someone cut in front of them in line. Now, this is Putnam's academic term for all that. Ready? He said, people in faith communities are nicer. Had to get a PhD for that one. Dave, what's the Greek word for nicer? Sorry. And Putnam at the time could not identify why specifically that was, but only that it was. And it wasn't just that folks could be connected in any kind of community. It had to be a community of faith. And he thought, well, it must be the people who are strongest in their faith, who are the most spiritually mature, who are the most devoted, they're going to serve more outside. He didn't find that connection. He thought it was mostly just a matter of being around people of faith. Now, since then, there's been some other research, and they have identified that the more devoted one is, the more likely they are to serve. But initially, he couldn't see the connection. So we serve because the world needs it. We serve because we're among the group of people most likely to do so. And here's the third reason, and I almost didn't want to tell you this one, because it takes a little bit of the self-emptying out of it. But I'll tell you anyway, in the spirit of disclosure. People who serve live better lives. They're happier, less prone to depression, more connected, live longer, and live healthier. Data supported, all of it. And the older you are, the more likely this is to be true. The older you are, the more likely it is to be true. And there are a couple of qualifiers, though. This serving of others can't be forced upon you. Somehow the health benefits go away if you're doing, and if you've ever done something out of a sense of, you know, burden and obligation, I don't even think you need another study for that. But also, you have to be able to see that it makes a difference, that it can't just be busy work. All right. So we serve because Jesus serves. We serve because the world needs it. We serve because we're in the population most likely to do so. And we serve because, guess what? It turns out we live better lives that way too. So not all of you were here last week. I have to tell you that the sermon was very long. And it was long because I had a lot to say. And I apologize for the length. I don't apologize for the content. It was good content, but it was long. So here's the thing. Today's sermon is going to be even longer. Oh, man. Why did we come today? Here's why and here's how. I'm not going to talk much longer at all. But the sermon is going to be longer because today at Atonement is God's work, our hands, Sunday, and we have a serving fair downstairs. And when we leave, we're going to go down that way. Don't worry, there won't be people like blocking the doors. But you're going to want to go down there, right? There's swag bags down there. Right? So 17 ministries from Beyond Atonement, ministry partners, in some cases very close partners, in other cases not as close, but still partners. And then ministries at Atonement that serve into a world that so desperately needs it. And so it's not a hard close, but it's a way for you to explore ways in which you might serve. And that's really what makes the sermon so long, because it's not going to end today. It's going to carry out in the days of your life when you serve, because you find that Jesus and Paul were right. It truly is better to give than to receive. Amen.